In a world that can be challenging, and at times unpredictable, it's hard to find moments to focus on what you need. Join Stephanie James on The Spark as she guides you to use your inner flame to ignite your best life. As a best-selling author, psychotherapist, transformational life coach, and international show host, Stephanie is dedicated to helping you create a life that takes you, your goals, and your passions to the next level, so you can live a life that is fully lit up and fully alive. She believes that your life is meant to be a beautiful expression of the things that light you up. That by living your dreams, you give permission to others to do the same. Are you ready to feel alive and inspired to fuel your dreams and put a fire behind your desires? Let's ignite a spark in one another that will illuminate the world. The Spark, with your host, Stephanie James, starts now.
Welcome to The Spark. I'm your host, Stephanie James. So happy to have you with us here tonight. I'm absolutely thrilled to have my guest tonight, Jamie Wheel, who's author of the global bestseller and Pulitzer Prize nominated Stealing Fire, and founder and executive director of the Flow Genome, which is an international organization dedicated to research and training of the ultimate human performance. He's an expert on peak performance and leadership, specializing in the neuroscience and application of flow states. I'm absolutely thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me, Jamie.
Sure.
We're going to be talking about your book, Recapture the Rapture, which after I had listened to Stealing Fire, I was so on fire with everything that you're doing that I was like, I couldn't wait for Recapture the Rapture. And honestly, I have so many questions that it would be like a 4-hour interview. So I worked really hard to condense them down. You know, because right now we're in this state of the world where, as a psychotherapist, I have a lot of clients that come in, and even, you know, friends, people I'm dealing with who feel like, oh my gosh, you know, we're in the end of times. You know, that things are really difficult right now, and we live in this world of, you know, things are very uncertain and unpredictable. So you talk in the beginning of the book about the true meaning of the world of the word apocalypse, and that it's not really the end of the world, but the end of an age and the lifting of the veils, you know, and yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically just to kind of say the sort of, you know, almost like the dictionary or the lexicon for the eschaton, which is the Greek term for the end of time. And most of the time when we talk about apocalypse and Armageddon and rapture, these kind of terms, we just sort of lump them all in this category of like strange things that Jesus people believe in, or, you know, or it just means a sort of generic, really bad time with maybe a happy ending. But they're actually very distinct. They speak to different things, and they have different responses that we would want to have for them. And so the first is, as you said, the apocalypsis is the Greek term, and it means the unveiling. And that's literally like the things that we didn't used to know or notice, we now do. They're staring us in the face. And I think everybody, regardless of political persuasion these days, is feeling that more or less accurately, right? But they are feeling it really, really strongly. And that sense, and that has led to, in extreme versions, the rise of conspiracy theories and movements, right? The sort of hermeneutics of suspicion, you know, that idea that actually no one is to be trusted, and that much of the energy and discourse is no longer about getting to mutuality, shared reality. It's to unmask. I was kind of thinking it's like Scooby-Doo, you know, like pulling the mask off the bad, you know, the spooky monster. And I would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for you, Red Bat, and your rascally kids. It's kind of like that. So that's apocalypsis. Like, we actually want to get as close to base reality as we can. And if that includes, oh, wow, pharmaceutical companies aren't always awesome, you know, or hey, big governments aren't always, they're just filled with humans. There's no wizard behind the curtain. And there's a bunch of very fallible, you know, very heavy-handed responses coming and going. If the, you know, whatever, or I thought my neighbors were nice and they've turned out not to be, you know, a kind of a broad spectrum, or even, you know, Paris Accords and climate change. If I recycle, I'm doing my bit, right? And people are now realizing, excuse me, oh, recycling of plastics for the last 20 years was a total sham. They're not going anywhere except on barges to China, and now China's not taking them anymore. You're like, what? So yes, lots of apocalypses, lots of apocalyptic realities there. The next would be Armageddon, and that is comes from the, there's a hill outside the Israeli town of Haifa called Har Megiddo. And that is supposed to be the location for the final battle at the end of time, right? And that is a doozy. So you might want to say we want to accelerate the apocalyptic thinking, stripping away the veils. We want to delay Armageddon because it's game over for everybody at that point. And then we get to the final one, rapture. And rapture is, you know, the notion of rapture really has, you know, in the title of the book, Recapture the Rapture, is it's dual pronged, right? Because on the personal level, to be in a state of rapture is to be in a state of bliss, inspiration, wholeness, right? All of courage, love, all those fantastic things. It's about sort of pegging out the meter on 11, right? So yes, we absolutely want to reclaim our joy and our possibility. And there's that sense of the, you know, the sort of biblical rapture as laid out in Revelations and other books, where it's like, that's the time where, you know, all the good people get whisked up to heaven and all the bad people get left to sort it out, right? And part of the point in the book is that, hey, we're seeing lots of rapture ideologies right now. And they're not all religious, right? That they can show up in, we're going to go to Mars and get out of this. We're going to have, you know, nation states are just going to magically evaporate and all of our crypto bros are going to rule the world on floating seasteads, and that's going to do it. Or psychedelic renaissance, and everyone's going to go and have MDMA therapy and cure their trauma, and then we're all going to be wonderful people, and then we'll figure it all out, right? So once you realize that there's an awful lot of kind of hockey stick happy endings that are being proposed right now, and that all of them really only work for a percent of the human population. It could be the smartest, it could be the most moral, it could be the most pious, it could be whatever it would be, but it's only, it could be the wealthiest, it could be the, but they're only 1% solutions. And if there's a sense of like, hey, this world as we know it isn't savable, there's an inflection point coming. On the other side of that inflection point, this little band of people are saved. In fact, things are even better for us out there. Then it becomes really pathological. You know, because we say, I disconnect from my humanity. I disconnect from caring about everyone everywhere. And I've started already moving into, hey, this is about us, and those folks are going to be left behind. So that would be my sense as far as, you know, we need to hasten the apocalypse. We need to delay to the last possible moment, Armageddon. And we need to recapture both our raptures, our healing, bliss, inspiration, courage, and the narrative, the story of the rapture. What do we do now?
Well, and it really, from what you wrote and from, you know, my own experience, it's so much now moving into, it's got to be us, even though we live in this cancel culture right now. And we live in a place where it still is us and them, and where there's so much divisiveness in our world. That's part of what I'm hearing is how we can join together, how we can come together to make it through this. And you're right. I mean, I feel that so much. It's the grand disillusionment. And we've, you know, come into this place where we see, like you said, behind the curtain of Oz. And, you know, as the Sufis talk about, we're lifting the veils. But as we lift those veils, we get to see the essence. We get to see the truth of what's really being revealed. And I think one of the things that you spoke about that is, I think, important as we're dealing with this is, you know, that we really are going through these stages of grief. You know, I think about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, this denial, anger, bargaining, depression, not necessarily that people yet maybe have gone through acceptance. Maybe in some cases I'm seeing apathy, but what do you think, you know, how do we appropriately grieve the loss of what we've known as comforts in the world? You know, this kind of, you know, we'll never go back to the way things were. You're talking about, you know, we have to move forward. So how do we embrace appropriately, or how do we appropriately grieve so that we can embrace what is to come?
Well, there's a fellow, Martin Prechtel, who's a Mayan elder and poet, and he's written many, many beautiful things. But one of the things he said is, grief is praise. It is the way love honors what it misses. So if there's ways for us to grieve by praising the things we love, right? Praising, you know, perhaps a world that was in some form of ecological balance, praising a time when, you know, America stood for goodness and truly liberty in the world. Now, obviously, mixed bag, like history is complicated. But, you know, coming out of World War II was kind of the last time we were unequivocally team good guy. Right. And it just got weirder from there. Right. So I think, you know, and of course, many retro political and cultural movements, make America great again, has a very strong, you know, backwards focus. So I think there's a sense of, I mean, hell, man, I'm going on a big backcountry ski trip and, you know, with my son, to Alaska, and I want him to experience big mountains and that whole wild experience. We were visiting family in South Africa a few years ago and got to take our kids into Botswana on a really beautiful extended overland safari. And it was just like, take this in, guys, take this in, you know, like it's beautiful. It's profound. It may not be here forever. And there's, I think, this toggling backwards and forwards between clutching at stuff as it slips through our fingers, you know, and almost sort of building an altar for it. You know, it's like, that's another thing that Martin Prechtel says. He has a beautiful phrase where he talks about feeding the holy, and that when we get, and this is obviously up for a lot of people right now, like, whoa, humans are a pox on this planet, you know, and you see it expressed with Thanos or Killmonger in Black Panther. You see a lot of the rise of anti-heroes these days who are actually speaking truth. It's just that the thing that they've chosen that has to be done to save everybody is pathological, right? So the Captain Americas of the world come in and go, no, you can't do that. That would be wrong. But they're not wrong. They're actually just seeing things clearly, right? So one of the things that Martin talks about with the Mayan culture was, hey, humans have always extracted. We've always chopped down trees for our buildings and for our firewood. We've always killed and hunted animals for our food. Like, we take. That's a part of it. That's not original sin. That's not capitalism. That's not any of the kind of different ways we might quickly say that's why and that's how we suck or we're wrong. It's like, we do consume. So the only thing to do is, you can't feel bad about our existence, but you can feed the holy. You can actually put a circle of cornmeal and put candles and sing the songs for the sun coming up, you know, and thank and praise the tree you cut down or the animal you hunt. And so some version of that, the grief is praise, right? And it's the way love honors what it misses, combined with feeding the holy, feels important. And to make no bones about it, like, it's that in and of itself isn't going to reel us back in from carbon limits or from whatever. But it does root us in not missing the beauty that is still present and all around us. And it just might, you know, it just might change something for someone somewhere. Right? I was just reading an article, I think in the New Yorker, about this. Oh, actually, it was Smithsonian Magazine. There was this fellow, he's now in his 80s, but he's lived up in New England for all of his life. And he found old growth forests in New England, which people had assumed were all 100% cut down during the colonial era, like for ships and buildings and all the stuff. And he would find little crazy creeks and little grottos and just like places where loggers hadn't gone, couldn't have got them out, let them be. And at first people didn't believe him. And then, you know, and he's just become this sort of, it's almost like the Lorax, right? And there are these beautiful stands of trees, and he brings people to them. And, you know, Harvard School of Forestry, all sorts of people are in there, and they're learning tremendous amounts about carbon sequestration, what is the value of old trees, how much more potent they are in securing carbon than new growth, you know? And so you're like, oh, so here's this intersection of beauty, awe, connection to the natural world, and then agency, you know, and information. So like, we now know more, and we're inspired or moved to do something about it. So I don't think this ever ends. I think this is going to be a perpetual cycle, right? Where we get knocked down by our grief and by the loss, and then somehow we find our ways back up. And then there's a period where we're like, okay, I know what's what, and I'm willing to keep going in spite of this. And then some new hard or sad thing will come along. And I think that's kind of the point, the purpose of the book is, what's a DIY toolkit for managing that grief, healing ourselves, remembering our highest inspiration and purpose, and being able to connect to each other? Because my sense is that this is a washing machine, you know, or a flywheel. It's not going to stop. There's not a specific fixed point happy ending.
Yeah, it never gets to that point of where, you know, it really is the rapture where everyone's, you know, the good people are taken up and the bad people all stay here, as you said, and fight it out. So if this is this continual cycle, then it's like, what do we do and how do we make meaning here and now, you know? And it's so beautiful what you were talking about, because I think that that's one of the things when we are in reverence for what's happening here and in touch with nature and looking at it as a sense of the sacred or holy. And when we're in that place, then maybe we make different decisions about it. Maybe we interface and interact with it differently. And I was reminded as you were sharing that about taking your son skiing in Alaska, that there was a woman I worked with who was a grandmother. And I loved that she did this when she was on vacation with her grandchildren. They'd be up camping and she would always ask them to circle around and hold hands. And at that moment, she would say, "Let's make a memory." And they would hold hands. And in that moment, it was that imprinting to say, this is important. You know, this is something sacred. Let's mark it on our hearts. And I love that as a way forward is if we realize that there isn't an end point, how can we make what's happening now the most essential, the most sacred? And I think about, we have to think about the future. Of course, it's not like you said, let's just all feel like we're in this pretend world where we're recycling and that's not happening. You know, we have to be aware of also what is happening so we can do something about it. One of the things though that I wanted to ask you about, you know, as this grandmother was talking about making meaning, you talk in the book about meaning 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0. Would you discuss that a little bit? What your definitions of that is? I feel like that's such an important part as we talk about the evolution of meaning in our world.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, really, for almost all of human history, right, your clan, tribe, nation, whatever it would have been, oriented around a specific religion and, you know, of various everything from animist, you know, early spirituality to, you know, the kind of Abrahamic faiths and everything else, right? So meaning 1.0, who am I? What's my place in the universe? How ought I act or behave, et cetera, was always determined by organized religion up until really the sort of middle of the 20th century. And then a progressive decline until in the last decade or so, it's really actually for the first time ever in human history, you know, which is really worth thinking about. There are more people who don't subscribe to a specific institutional religion than do, as far as any specific other group, right? So the nuns, the none of the aboves, you know, I'm spiritual but not religious, or I'm agnostic, or I'm atheistic, or anything else, is now the largest and fastest growing group. So you're like, oh, wow, okay. So, you know, and then throw in things like church scandals, you know, and the erosion of that kind of just unilateral truth, authority, power experience, right? You can say that meaning 1.0 is sagging, if not collapsing. Meaning 2.0, which really seems like it kind of got its biggest start with the European Enlightenment, so the sort of 1700s, was that whole, you know, as everybody knows, kind of Descartes, Rousseau, Hobbes and Locke, you know, blah, 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 right? All men and women are created equal, entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So civil rights, private property rights, rule of law, science, right? Big one. This is the way things are. If I can capture it or measure it with the five senses, then it's real. If I can assign a market value to it, then it's real. If it exists on the legal books, then it's real. You know, that was kind of was our world. And in many instances, it was seen as a, you know, a very forward-looking corrective to the dark superstitions, right, of the Middle Ages kind of thing. So yay, right? And that gave us really, you know, it gave us the era of European colonialism, but also gave us the rise of the nation state, right? The 20th century, all the way up through things like the United Nations, right? All that good stuff. And then, you know, particularly as we've seen, well, gosh, I mean, we've seen it on, at this point, all sides of the political spectrum, but whether it's alt-right or far-left social justice, right? You've seen both sides of that. Be like, this is a bill of goods. This doesn't work for us. We've been, you know, we've been stitched up. These promises, right? Of if you just sit quietly and wait for your turn in line, you'll get yours soon enough. Behave, right? Evolution, not revolution. All these kind of things, and or trust science, right? Which has been especially under the gun in the last couple of years. More and more people are skeptical of that. When you're like, wait, the big fancy banks and Goldman Sachs and McKinsey, and you guys are doing shadier shit, right? And getting away with it. And this whole white collar crime thing. And like, we trusted you guys and you've absolutely just sold us down the river. Those kinds of things have been stacking up. And, you know, and obviously the stutter steps with the WHO and the CDC and all these kind of things where they're like, wait, you guys were supposed to be the professionals and the experts. You were supposed to know what's going on. And you're now lying to us that we shouldn't get masks. We don't need them. But really, it was because healthcare workers needed them. And now you tell us we do need them, but we're not going to make a big deal of this. So everybody can just wear a cloth mask, which is totally goddamn useless. So we're going to have that for a year and a half while no one's jacked up production on N95. You know, you're just like, you guys are asshats. Right? Simple, you know, it is a common response. So meaning 1.0 collapses, meaning 2.0 on the other side collapses. And, you know, meaning 1.0, right, offered salvation, right? But it was exclusive salvation. If you believed in our God, you were saved. If you didn't, if you believed in some other God, then you were a heathen, a pagan, a heretic, right? So exclusive salvation. And meaning 2.0, right? The nation state, civil rights, civil liberties, all these kind of things was inclusive, but it got rid of salvation. God is dead. Separation of church and state, right? There's no one to tell you what meaning was. So salvation or inclusion. And meaning 3.0, which would be, what would it be like if, right, we could have an inclusive salvation? What would it be like if there was a way for us to make sense of the world where people can, you know, everybody, everywhere, has a seat at the table and has the ability to feel redeemed, whole, on purpose, cared for, dignified, seen. So that's kind of the prospect. And my sense was, is that obviously that can't be a tops down. You know, like when we've tried tops down solutions, whether it's communism or fascism or whatever it would be, like those don't tend to end well. Right. Because, right, there's one of the key elements of human nature is free will. You know, I don't know whether that's built in or whether it's just a value we have held, you know, but free will crops up in every origin myth, you know, everybody's mythologies, right? Like there's something in there about an individual's right to choose. Now, obviously, it's been wildly mixed in different societies over time. But there's something in there. And so the question is how do we kind of create an open source template, kind of like WordPress? You know, I don't need to know how to code in order to build a halfway decent looking website, right? So how can we do that for culture architecture so that people can build what is meaningful and necessary for themselves and their communities, you know, for us, by us, and almost use that design firm IDEO. They have this beautiful human-centered design toolkit where they were like, we design cool stuff for Apple and, you know, fancy companies in Silicon Valley. But then what's really cool about what we do is how we do it, and how we do it's involving all the people involved. Right. And so let's make that toolbox free and accessible. And so basically people all around the developing world have been using that to solve things like indoor drinking water or micropayments for, you know, rural people moving to cities, right? Or women, you know, girls' literacy and education, whatever it would be. And it's built by people for people, not tops-down solutions, right? From a bunch of, you know, fundamentally white folks far away with stroking checks. So that would be our sense, is that if we're going to have meaning 3.0, it would need to look fundamentally different than 1.0 or 2.0, which were somewhat more tops down. This is what you should think, and have it come be bottoms up. But also making sure that not everybody's just trying to build a rocket in their driveway. Here's a toolkit. This actually does go to the moon, right? Now you can wrap it in anything you want, right? You can believe whatever you want to believe, right? But this is how, this, these are the functionalities, right? That will deliver most of the core nutrients, you know, the sort of core psychosocial social nutrients you might need.
So we're going to need to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk with you more about this and really, because I feel like Recapture the Rapture, it's a resource for how we can step into this, how we can truly make meaning of what's going on now. And it's like a guidebook through it. And so when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jamie Wheel. And just look forward to having you back here on The Spark.
Learn how to lead a happier life on TransformationTalkRadio.com.
So welcome back to The Spark. I'm your host, Stephanie James, and I'm here with Jamie Wheel. And we've been talking about his incredible book, Recapture the Rapture. The secondary title is Rethinking God, Sex, and Death in a World That Has Lost Its Mind. Lord knows that's true. You know, Jamie, one of the things I was thinking during the break is, you know, we were talking about meaning 1.0 and 2.0, the collapse of those, and meaning 3.0. I'm curious for you on just a personal level, what do you find most meaningful in your life now as you're navigating through these times?
I mean, it's the kind of the same thing that the same answer I've always had when people have asked me, like, because people will often say, oh, you clearly seem like you're coming from someplace, you know, like you have a point of view. Where is it? Who's your teacher? Who's your guru? What's your practice? And I'm like, don't really have any of those things. But I would say, like, the sort of the four M's, you know, like music, mountains, mushrooms, and marriage, you know, so like, right. So, but meaningfully, like sincerely, right. So music, like not, yes, day in, day out listening, because it just fills in the voids of your life and creates a color and texture, but also very specifically live celebratory shows that drop you into the deep ecstatic now with, you know, fellow travelers, huge, huge place of renewal, remembering, right. Reaffirmation, mountains and oceans and forests, but big nature, no question about it. Sunrises and sunsets and full moons and shooting stars and canyons and old growth and, you know, hot springs and whatever, like 99.99% of humans' existence on this planet has been close to the earth. So the whole sort of kiss the ground is for me is non-negotiable. Mushrooms specifically, I mean, you could throw in a host of, I would say, compounds that facilitate insight and healing, would just be the, and especially combined with music and nature, you know, and maybe yeah. Someone you love, right? Those become a profound place to reset and renew and remember what you've forgotten, what's yours to do, where you still have work to do on the fixing and the patching. And then marriage, very specifically, I mean, really it's the whole shooting match, right? But like dyadic partnership, regardless of legal status, right? Like being actually in relation with another and, you know, presumably and hopefully also engaged in, you know, intimate relational practice as well. Because as I make the case in the book, it's, you know, that is how evolutionary biology wired up our nervous systems, you know, and put all the incentives, so tons of really powerful hormonal and neurochemical reinforcement to the act of procreation. It's just tragic that it also creates so much suffering for people. It's the source of that, you know, probably if you really trace it all back, probably over half of human suffering is coming from our sexual imprinting. You know, and you're just like, oh my God, that's terrible. Like we are literally just puppets on strings of amoral evolution. So what if we actually cut those strings? You know, what if we learn to hotwire the evolutionary impulse? And instead of just being jerked around by it in really, really predictable ways, what if we could actually use that to the Healing Insight and Growth Project, which is not a new idea. It's been around for thousands of years across the world, but it hasn't been, I think, shared in a common sense, biological, neurological way. It's often been an esoteric mystery school. It's had all sorts of fancy waistcoats. It makes it really hard for people today to get into, to understand it even. But just that idea of like, of course, our bodies and our brains and our relationships, they're not only their great balances and filters, not only is companionship and deep care for another, give us the space to settle into what's next, you know, and what is. But there is also something really powerful of fundamentally really good friends with benefits.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. And I love the four M's. I think that when I was listening in the book, when you were talking about, if we just focus first on the music part, when you were talking about the experience of Freddie Mercury at Live Aid, you know, I was a kid during those times. And I remember watching that live. And after listening to it in the book, I had to go back and watch it again. And I was brought to tears, you know, with the realization of how music does. I wasn't aware until I listened to it in your book about how music does bring us to those moments, and that 40% of the world at that point was connected. And yeah. And so the power of that to me, and the power, and I've, you know, and I've been in those situations. I mean, I've sang for many bands, and I've also definitely gone to so many shows and been in that, talking about rapture of that moment of how music can move through us and then as us. It's really powerful.
Full disclosure though, right? Like my, I am, what would I call it? An agnostic chaos magician, if I was anything, right? And that's not what I would ever identify as, but like, if you really had to say, well, how do you show up consistently? Because there's sort of high magic and low magic, right? And high magic was, you know, in the European mystery schools, all that kind of stuff, you know, lots of vestments and fancy Latin or Hebrew or whatever. And it was very precise. And this is how you did it. And then in the like 1960s and 70s, there kind of came up with this sort of almost punk rock magic, you know, and it was like, hey, actually, none of that shit really matters. Do the thing that works. Do the thing that works. And that's everything. Right. And either feel it yourself, borrow, innovate, right? Whatever it would be, but like dispense with a lot of the fancy waistcoats, right? And you could say the same about any form of sexual fitness, right? Which typically, if you, you know, started Googling this stuff, you'll end up in like neo-tantra hell realms, you know, with people talking about yonis and vajras and this and that, and, you know, and jade eggs and whatever, right? And you're like, ah, this is not my jam. So people often ask, you know, me, obviously they ask lots of people this, but you know, like, do you do anything in particular before psychedelic experiences or whatever it be? And my typical answer is no. I make damn sure I'm in the right place with the right people, with the right compound. That's it. And after that, I mean, and then for sure, I think you can, you can do a lot to stabilize, ground and bound the energy, and the, because even if you just see it as nothing more than aesthetics, right? You don't have to subscribe to some metaphysical element. There's a sort of Pythagorean geometries, right? And this is, could be how you arrange candles or how you arrange, you know, an altar or how you arrange whatever, but like a one, the one, the monad, unity; two, the dyad, a polarity; three, the triad, right? A triangle, that shape. Right? For the tetrad or square, right? Or two polarities, right? You know, like a management consulting 2x2, right? Is also a tetrad, right? And then five, the fifth, either the five-pointed star or the center of two polarities. Beyond that, I haven't found much need to add. And I often find that when people get much more complicated than that, they're often clogging the lane. And it's much more like, hey, stabilize, ground and bound, make things beautiful, and then get out of the way. Like whatever. I mean, Terence McKenna had a funny ass. I mean, he had lots of funny ass sayings, but one of them, he said, the real weirdness doesn't care whether you believe in it or not. It's going to kick down your door and grab you by the fucking throat. Right. So my experience has been that the real witness, the deepest, heaviest stuff we have ever found ourselves, has just found us. So there's much more of it. It feels much more like Harry Potter, you know, where he like suddenly finds the sword of Gryffindor, or suddenly has Fox's, you know, Phoenix feather. Like things happen to and through him beyond his own conscious manipulation or intent. But it had to be him, man. It had to be then.
Which I think is interesting. It's that thing that I feel like I'm hearing you say is like, as we get out of our own way too, that, and we kind of work on clearing whatever those cobwebs are, how we can become like a clearer conduit for that, whatever that is, to come through, for that consciousness to come through. And part of it is also like, I've always felt like as we do our own healing, and that's part of what I was hearing in the book, as we do our own healing, we also become clearer conduits for that love, that as we learn how to love ourselves better, as we learn how to heal, then we can bring that to others. We can bring that to humanity.
Well, yeah, but I also do want to do the full truth in advertising, right? And there's a reason why in the back third of the book, talk about the phrase, the bliss fuck crucifixion, right? Which is, you're like, what? It just snapped on my circuits. But the idea, like the bliss fuck part, is literally the neurological and potentially psychosexual, but not necessarily, just white light ecstatic experience that you can very precisely tune a human nervous system to experience. And it's awesome, right? It's literally like undulations and tremors and quivers and, you know, and inspiration and information and nonstop amazement. Great. And everybody wants to sign up for that, right? Precious few who want to are willing to be yoked, right? Are willing to step up to the other half, which is that if you find yourself in front of the burning bush, you know, unmediated information of source consciousness, it's also all the grief, all the tragedy, all the vulnerability, all the futility, right? All of those other things as well. And it feels like if you just go for the pleasure route, it absolutely cul-de-sacs your growth and fundamentally will make you sick.
Yeah.
And it could be as obvious as addiction, but it could also be ego inflation. It could be whatever it would be. It's an imbalance, a profound one. You know, if you blend it with, you know, if you blend the ecstasy with the agony and you actually use that positive feeling to allow you to open fully to the wounding of the world, then we have a chance at something transformative. Then we have a chance at what Gandhi called satyagraha, what MLK called called soul force, right? We have a chance to offer some transformative frequency of human testament. Like, I am here and this too. I don't flinch or withdraw or contract from any of this. And the very fact that I'm able to do that can send shockwaves through the world, you know, and not in a self-aggrandizing way, just in a very simple matter-of-fact way. Can we do this together? So it's absolutely the agony and the ecstasy. If we only had the agony, it would 100% crush us. If we only had the ecstasy, it would 100% burn us.
Well, and that's it. This is not about a spiritual bypass. It's not about just being in ecstasy. And I think that that's one of the things that's so powerful. I've always loved Rumi's poem, The Guest House, if you're familiar with that, you know, and it's about this human experience being a guest house. So it's welcoming whatever shows up at our door, whether it's a depression, a meanness, a sadness. And so that's part of what I'm hearing. And that's part of, I think, what I do in therapy, is that it's not that we avoid the uncomfortable feelings or the pain or the sorrow. We actually step into it. It's a fullness of our experience.
Yeah. And it's like, that's easier said than done, right? Because the whole thing is, most people get stuck fantasizing about getting to the top of the mountain, and many, you know, much messaging in the personal growth and self-help space and the kind of new religious space, whatever it would be, is all about the attainment of this place that will be truly nirvana, like the state without wind, the state without disruption, right? And if I can only get there, then my money problems, my relationship problems, my self-worth, my inner monologue, whatever it would be, those will all resolve. And then I get to go skipping off down the garden path. And it's like, no, that's just not, like, not only is that not realistic, but that's not reality, right? Reality contains, like, the whole nature is red in tooth and claw stuff. It includes all of that also. So the capacity to realize that the 12 o'clock, the top of the mountain, isn't the whole shooting match. I've actually got to return home, all the way home, right? I mean, if Dorothy had just fucked off to Oz, right, she never would have ever had the epiphany. There's no place like home, right? So the hero has to return home, but then even that is you know, good, but not quite finished. Then you actually need to move to the center of the clock, which is where Rumi's guest house is coming from, right? It's welcome it all, the highs and the lows, but even when you're in the lows, you haven't forgotten the gig. You haven't forgotten the cosmic joke. You haven't forgotten that this is option, you know, whatever. I mean, fill in the blank for your explanatory mechanism, whether this is optional or whether this is just beautiful or whatever it would be. But I think it's the moving to the center of the clock, not getting stuck at 12 and just taking your selfie for sure. But then also not just coming home to slowly get beaten down by the mundanity of it all.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so what this is reminding me of is a question that I had for you too. Of at one point you're talking about the infinite game, and what is your definition of that, Jamie?
Well, this is James Cass's, you know, very well known little pamphlet of a book, Finite and Infinite Games. And he just basically said, finite games is how most humans have done most things for most of history, and those are one up, one down, win lose kind of games, and those can be. Those can be who gets to eat the woolly mammoth. Those can be sexual. They can be political. They can be economic. They can be social. They can be whatever. But one up, one down. I win, you lose. And the infinite game, he says, there is only one, right? It's the infinite game. It kind of includes everything it touches, which is how can we keep playing together, right? It becomes win-win. And the job isn't to win and end the game. The job is to include as many people in the game as possible and extend it as long as possible. And so if you combine that with, you know, the Enlightenment, and you know, sort of the European Enlightenment, that idea that for the first time ever, at least articulated in a way we still have access to, all humans on the planet everywhere were entitled to the same consideration and a shot at the good life, right? That was fairly radical. I mean, for sure, people had said all kinds of positive, encouraging things about their people. But to say this, the smelly bastards across the river also, you know, and the lighter or darker or and weirder people way over around the back of the end. No, that's never been said. So it seems like, particularly as we go into a planet, you know, straining under the loads of 8 billion people on a waning fossil fuel economy, right? How we relate to all those people and why, and how we say, because I mean, you know, and we're starting to see the fracturing of that infinite game, right? To me, that is the one thing that I will absolutely go to the mattress on as far as defending the Western legacy, right? Because people are critiquing, you know, especially on the political left and the social justice movements, really just saying this is, you know, the 1619 project, like America is nothing but an extractive, you know, slaving, oppressive organization. And you're like, absolutely that, yes. And potentially this other thing. And it was this infinite game, potentially, you know, and it was partially executed. It was constantly getting captured by you know, powered interests, all those things. But it's there. And when we've been at our best, whether it's Lincoln on the, you know, doing the Gettysburg Address, you know, in a field of carnage, whether it's MLK and the I Have a Dream speech, even when it's, I mean, if you look more recently, you've got George Bush, you know, on the rubble of the Twin Towers, you've got Obama in Charlottesville. There's a couple of these instances where they very explicitly, and I'm sure their speech writers were, you know, thinking in terms of history and legacy, they call out the better angels of our nature. They call back to the founding principles of the country. They admit current shit show I totally understand. And they lead their people to double down on the infinite game that's at the core of the American experiment and really at the core of that enlightenment, you know, social technology. And so that to me feels super important, because if we don't do that, you suddenly have a splintering and a fact. I think my sense is, and this is potentially helpful for listeners, which is right now, we're obviously super duper polarized. And so alt-right, far left feel like they are as far apart as you could possibly be, right? And in entrenched opposition. But there was a study at an Australian university that did tests on far left, far right, and centrist kind of folks, and tested them for authoritarianism, like a psychological disposition towards command and control. And then what they call the dark triad personality types, narcissism, Machiavellianism, and sociopathy or psychopathy, right? So generally not nice people. And cluster B, generally not fixable.
Yeah.
Right. So if you deal with those people, you're like, oh, I'll give you psychedelics, or, you know, or I'll give you EQ, emotional intelligence training. You make things much, much worse by giving cluster B folks additional tools and power. Right. So the thing that the Australian university found was that, super interestingly, the centrists, who were like, I have my beliefs, I might hold them quite strongly, but I don't extrapolate that other people have to believe what I believe, scored, very low statistical correlation on any of those four characteristics. But both the alt-right and the far left did. They were off the charts. So you're like, oh, wow. So now what we have is we have social movements, and these are for the finite game, right? Both of those groups are saying smash and grab tribalism. We get what's coming to us, and we are aggrieved, right? And we dehumanize. And there's some additional studies by our buddy Scott Barry Kaufman at Penn and Columbia, who have shown that, you know, that when people engage a victimhood mentality and orientation, they're more strident, they're less forgiving, there's less compassion, there's more othering, there's all these other things that go on as well. So you're like, oh wow, we've got the shittiest people on both sides actually on the same team. They're on team finite game. Now, they're flying different flags, but philosophically, they both want to dehumanize a group and validate for their tribe versus the finite game. I mean, versus the infinite game, versus the all of us or none of us, and our job is to keep playing. And I think what is an important distinction there, because there's so much strife right now, and there's so much like, can't we all get along? Can't we all get on the same page? I actually don't think that getting on the same page, beyond that, beyond committing to the infinite game, we're not supposed to get on the same page. There's actually a phrase called agonistic liberalism, which basically means like antagonistic, like we're opposite each other. We are fighting. We are knocking heads. We never agree. And that's actually as good as it gets, right? And that we should be mature enough to realize that's as good as it gets, and to honor and celebrate and even cherish the conditions that allow that agonistic liberalism to happen, right? So those are kind of some of the some of the possibilities of playing the infinite game. Plus, it's just more fun, right? The idea of like, hey, if we're playing a game and you're not in it, like a non-player character, then my job is to help turn you into a player, right? If you're wandering around, checked out, going through the motions, and then someone can be really kind to you, really friendly, do something ludicrous that makes you laugh, right? A flash mob in a shopping mall, whatever it would have been, that you're just like, pattern interrupt. Oh my gosh, this is possible, right? And so you turn non-player characters into characters, and then, you know, you find characters and you're like, hey, we could also do this. This is the infinite game. Do you want to build something? Yes, let's build something even better. And then you turn characters or players into architects. And that feels like an infinitely fun expression of the infinite game.
Well, and as you talk about this, you know, I was aware, and as I was aware of listening to your book, you know, the sense of hope starts to arise. And I loved your, as you were talking about, it's not enough to just have hope. We have to be hope. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, that was actually from Cornel West at Harvard Divinity School. He said, having hope is too detached, too spectatorial. You got to be hope, right? And that notion of like, what kind of hope do we need right now? I think it's fair to say that we need massively inspirational, but also durable hope, because there's kind of the whistling past the graveyard hope, right? Which is just inadequate. You're like, I'm going to whistle so that if there really is a big, scary monster, they're not going to come and get me. Like, does that work? Probably not, right? So really flimsy. And like, that's maybe that Glasgow or the governments will come up with better climate accords, or maybe Trump will get elected again in 2024 or won't, whatever, which way you go, right? Or maybe, you know, blockchain, you know, whatever, right? The sort of pinning some almost childish hope that somebody somewhere has this all figured out and will save us, right? Those won't last. And actually, Admiral Jim Stockdale, who was the highest ranking POW in Vietnam. So he was in a Vietnamese prison camp for 9 years, no fun. And he noticed that the who lived and who died, basically. And he was like, oh, well, the pessimists didn't live. No surprise. They were despondent. They gave up their will to live. And sure enough, they died. But he said also the optimists died. And the optimists died because they had these little lifeboats that they were clinging to, like the boys will be home for Christmas, the boys will be home for July the 4th. And when the boys were still in prison in a bamboo cage, right, a year or 2 years later, they just crumpled. So, you know, he actually kind of coined the concept of the Stockdale paradox. Who survived? What do you need to survive? And that was basically the idea that you have to be sort of ruthlessly honest about short-term reality, what's actually going on, while remaining relentlessly optimistic about the long-term future. And, you know, you apply that to now, and I think the only honest answer I can come up with is that we're in for a hard landing. And our goal, and this goes a lot to like diseases of despair and anxiety and depression and all the things that many of us are feeling more and more these days, right? Non-specific grief. I mean, you must have this in the DSM-5, right? There's adjustment disorder. Mm-hmm. Something like if you've had trouble, you know, managing and integrating an adverse life event for longer than 6 months, you might have, you know, adjustment disorder. It's like, yeah, no shit. We've all got adjustment disorder.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Right. So my sense is that we are ill prepared for what's ahead. I mean, that's an understatement of all understatements. But quite specifically, I'm not talking about like bottled water and canned goods, although that also, like, basically if people's phones run out, they're fucked, right? I can't get anywhere. I can't order anything. I don't know where I am. I don't know how to get to where I'd like to be. I can't, you know, like literally our lives hinge on our iPhone batteries. So we are deconditioned zoo animals, but we are also more than that. Like the last century, and this is like Vivek Murthy's book, Together. There's the, you know, the one from a decade ago, Bowling Alone. There's all these things, right? The last century has seen a total breakdown in nuclear family, intergenerational family. People move 5, 6, 7 times for jobs. They live in states that are different from their parents. We pack our elders off to nursing homes to get sedated and looked after by minimum wage employees, right? There's this whole collapse in the family unit. And at the same time, there's been the rise of, fundamentally, you know, madmen marketing. The idea that whatever, and you might not have even known you had this issue, right? Whether it's restless leg syndrome or chronic halitosis or dandruff or, you know, or whatever it would have been, right? We're going to inform you. We're going to scare the shit out of you. And then we're going to sell you the thing to fix you. And interestingly, all the original, and this is Tim Wu at Columbia's book. He wrote a book called The Attention Merchants. The rise of modern marketing was actually all literal, like actual. They had been snake oil salesmen or failed preachers. 100%. The first wave, there's like 3 or 4 of them. They all set the initial conditions, which was fundamentally fall from grace, right? You know, you're in a place of suffering, promised, you know, holy communion, buy the thing, take the product, do whatever, and then redemption, salvation. And whether that's you're going to look sexy and cool and be tan playing volleyball on the beach like all those other kids in the Coors Light ads or whatever it would be, right? Those versions. So we got fractured out of intergenerational family awareness. And we got conditioned over decades and decades of anything that's wrong or off for me, I can and expect to get fixed, and I get expected to get fixed right now. And when it's not, I turn into Karen and call the manager. So there is no more manager, right? So that idea, this is not my beautiful life, right? This is not my large automobile. What the fuck? I want my money back. Like that is going to lead to extreme brittleness. And when you're describing your grandma going with her kids on the camping trip and holding hands and saying, let's make a memory, she was actually doing something really powerful there, because studies have shown, like, I think this was, it wasn't Chapel Hill, but it was University of North Carolina, I think. It was definitely a Carolina school, where they realized that children who had deep and meaningful connections to parents and grandparents on one or both sides were less anxious, more resilient, higher SAT scores, greater college admissions and completion. They recovered from illness and injuries and setbacks. It's almost the simplest example I can think of is like a little Jeep ricocheting down the road with a short, short wheelbase. You know, the distance between the wheels is small. Bop, 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 and it just bounces around versus a stretch limo where you just roll down the highway at 90 miles an hour and it's just butter smooth. So, you know, by having intergenerational awareness, right, we expand our wheelbase. We smooth out the potholes and the bumps of life. When it's just me, or let's make it even extreme, me on a unicycle, and I hit a pothole, bam-o, right? I eat shit. And so the sense of reinstituting intergenerational awareness, right, and a sense that I might not get all mine in this lifetime, but I am going to keep carrying the light, keep carrying the torch forwards. That's the sole goal. Do I get downfield yardage, right? Can I get this a little further than it when it was handed to me? And I'm doing this on behalf of my children's children. That to me feels like an essential adaptive strategy, right? Otherwise, we will break. People will literally just slip their wrist. They'll peace out. They'll be like, okay, I can see which way this wind is blowing. There's not enough here for me to keep me on this earth. Right? Versus, oh, we are actually building the ark, right? We are building the seed bank of culture and consciousness and love and beauty. And we're doing it to get through that hard landing, to get through that keyhole event, however big or small it turns out to be. But we're doing it so that our grandchildren, you know, it's like that time capsule they found in the base of that Robert E. Lee statue, you know, like, from here, we're going to put all the things we cherish and value and want you to know about us, but also in that, knowing more about you and having that kind of long-term commitment. So three generations behind me, I'm in the center. So my parents, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, thank you. That takes us all the way back to the Depression and the World War. So like, thank you. You know, and then three generations ahead, my children, my grandchildren, my great-grandchildren, and this is how I roll through life. You know, it is on behalf of my ancestors and descendants. And then and then only 1/7. I mean, obviously it'll probably be 50%, let's say, about me.
It's so powerful and beautiful, Jamie. I mean, because what it gives us is, again, it's like a blueprint that we can start following. You know, that we can start creating to get through. It's not to avoid it. It's through it.
I mean, some of my inspiration on that was the you know, obviously you look at any diaspora people who were kicked out from where they once lived and had been roaming for a long time. And you could think of like the Ashkenazi Jews, you could think of the Roma gypsies, you could think of the Kurds, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, you name it, right? There's all sorts of people around this planet that have not had an easy run of it. Right. And how did they do it? Right. And the Talmud, the Hebrew book, has that beautiful quote. We are not expected to finish the work, nor are we excused from it. And that just sums it up. You're like, it's too much. It's too big. This is going to crush me. If Atlas shrugged, I don't stand a chance. You're like, yep, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right on the scale, the enormity of the challenge. But suck it up, fat kid. You got to do it anyway, right? And that dialectic between those two truths to me is endlessly inspiring. because it sort of galvanizes us. It gives us a loving kick in the ass, but it also acknowledges the enormity of it all. And then it's just ours to do, you know, to pick up or fold.
Well, and as we're wrapping up now, Jamie, you know, I want to make sure that I have pages of questions. Like this could have been a 4-hour interview. there's so much and so much wisdom to be gleaned from this book and your incredible research. What do you feel like is the essential message that you want to leave with the listeners today?
Well, I mean, I would say the simplest is, it's time to set aside childish things, right? So if you've ever been wondering about a life of deeper meaning, connection, significance, the time is now. And the unraveling of the world is actually kind of a strange grace in giving ourselves permission to make those kinds of moves. That healing and inspiration and connection are essential nutrients in our lives. And if taken to their conclusion, can actually give us an experience of being twice born in this world. Where first born, we've just, you know, our parents canoodled and out we came. And then the world was cold and hard and weird. And many of us say, I didn't want this. I didn't sign up for this, and try to bypass it or transcend it, you know, via workshops or substances or relationships or shopping or, you know, whatever it would be. We're not in. We're not actually fully all in. But if you can have those kind of profound and life-changing initiatory experiences, and I lay out literally like the 9 steps in the book of how to have a death rebirth experience. As Goethe said, you know, die before you die, right? Or you will remain forever a stranger on this earth. So die before you die. And then like Ebenezer Scrooge, like Dorothy, you get to go, oh my gosh, I didn't know what I didn't know. I didn't know what I'm missing. I'm coming back a full fuck yes to this experience, this existence. And then live from there. Live from there with the courage, which is like, I've already died. So there's nothing else to happen here. The question is just, how do I live my life as art? How do I live my life as service? And how do I remember the infinite game and play it with everyone here? I'd say that's a great place to start.
Beautiful. Jamie, thank you so much. Thank you for your time and thank you for this interview. Where can people find out more about you?
Yeah, we're on Instagram and Facebook at Flow Genome, and also online at flowgenomeproject.com.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks for tuning in to The Spark with Stephanie James. Remember that you already have what you need to live a life that is fully lit and fully alive. You're already holding the flame. Now it's time to ignite your best life. Learn more at stephaniejames.world. That's stephaniejames.world. And tune in next week at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, only on transformationtalkradio.com. Shine on!
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.